This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Former basketball star Dennis Rodman's visit to North Korea may have drawn a lot of laughs, but no one is laughing about North Korea's latest threats to use nuclear weapons against South Korea and possibly the United States. This comes as a bipartisan group of former U.S. officials sent a warning that world leaders are not working fast enough to meet nuclear threats. And one of those sending that warning is a Georgian. Former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn is currently the chief executive officer of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. He's also a professor at the Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech. And in the Senate, he chaired the Armed Services Committee. Senator Nunn, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Dennis. Good to be with you.
North Korea recently conducted an underground nuclear test, and it appears that people who monitor what comes out of those tests have not been able to figure out whether they used enriched uranium or not to set it off. Why is that important, and why can't we tell at this point?
Well, there are really two ways to make weapon-usable material, and one way of making weapon-usable material is through making plutonium from spent fuel that has been run through reactors, and that's the way North Koreans have made their priority. But they also have hinted several times, and we believe that they probably are working actively on also making highly enriched uranium, which is a centrifuge process. It's another way of making weapon-grade material. So the North Koreans clearly have the nuclear capability now. We don't think they have sophisticated missiles that can pass through space and hit targets accurately in the United States. They certainly threaten their neighbors. And I must say that I think the Chinese are increasingly concerned about the North Koreans. So all of that spells a very dangerous situation.
You mentioned that they don't yet have the long-range delivery capacity, but they did fire a long-range ballistic missile back in December. Does that mean that they could now attach a warhead to that and perhaps hit targets much farther away, including possibly parts of the U.S.?
I don't think it means they can do that today, but it certainly means they're working on that capacity, and we have to assume that at some point they will. They are also going through a very, I would say, testy transition to a very young leader, but the young man is using, or his spokespeople are using, very harsh rhetoric now. And though we believe, at least I believe, that it's mainly aimed for internal audiences, of course it has a huge effect in South Korea and has effect in Japan. So the danger is they miscalculate, and that sets off a real reaction, which could be unfortunate and certainly could involve a very substantial conflict. So the North Koreans are dangerous, and sometimes we're not quite sure whether they take their own rhetoric seriously, but I think we have to.
I want to explore the rhetoric for just a moment. We've got some new video that shows the young leader, Kim Jong-un, telling some of his troops to, and these are his words, throw all the enemies into the cauldron, break their waists, and crack their windpipes. You hinted a little bit at this, that this might be more for internal consumption. He has to consolidate his hold in North Korea. But how seriously should we take that kind of overheated rhetoric?
Well, I don't think North Korea wants a war. If they have a war, they're going to lose the war. But the danger is that some of his military people may become more zealous and bolder. And they've, of course, demonstrated time and again that they are capable of taking provocative military action and taking action that costs the lives of a number of people. That's a different thing than believing they really want to start a war, but sometimes wars start because people use very thoughtless rhetoric and other people take it seriously, including people on the other side of the border. The most important thing here is the Chinese and what they may or may not do. They seem to be losing some of their patience that has been almost infinite with their friends in North Korea. We have to understand, though, that the Chinese have different fears. They fear a collapse of North Korea. They fear millions of refugees coming across their borders. They fear a border that would be, in their view, occupied by Americans and South Koreans. And I think what we have to do is have much more of a dialogue, much more of a frank, quiet dialogue, non-public with the Chinese, that would indicate to them that we understand their apprehensions and we're willing to deal with their apprehensions and help them with those apprehensions if worst case happens from their point of view. But they also have to understand our apprehensions and the apprehensions of South Korea and Japan, and our Chinese friends need to also understand that this harsh rhetoric being spewed out from the North could have repercussions in terms of even starting nuclear programs by some of the neighbors that would not be in, of course, China's interest.
Two-part question here, one about China and one about South Korea. Given our economic tensions with China, how good are our communications on the strategic front with them? Are we talking back and forth very well? And secondly, on South Korea, are you concerned that they might launch a preemptive strike against the North?
I don't think the South Koreans would do that, but I think the South Koreans have made it plain that their patience is not infinite and they're not going to have attacks take place on their own people. So the North, I think it needs to take that into account in terms of being much more cautious, not only in their actions, but in their rhetoric. As far as the Chinese are concerned, we have very good relations with them in terms of dialogue, but we don't have enough strategic conversations with them. We don't deal enough, in my opinion, with the fears that they may have, and we don't, I don't think, have enough understanding with them about what our country would do in the event there were a collapse of North Korea. And I don't think they have enough understanding about how dangerous it is for the North Koreans to continue their nuclear program and the repercussions that could be set off there with Japan and with South Korea and with others in that neighborhood. So can we improve the dialogue? Should it be more strategic? Should it be frank and candid? Yes, I'd say yes to all of those with the Chinese.
But how transparent should we be with the Chinese? I can see people in Congress being very concerned about that. And conversely, I imagine some of the leaders in China might not be exactly warm to opening up to us.
Well, that's certainly true, and there are trade tensions and so forth, but we have a real stake. Unfortunately, our fiscal situation, as you well know, is not under control, and unfortunately, we have to borrow very substantial amounts of money from China. China also depends on America as a market for their own economy, so we may not be eye to eye on all strategic matters, but we have very important economic mutual interest, and so we do need to continue our dialogue with the Chinese. It has gotten better over the years. I think it continues to get better, but we still have misunderstandings. But we have to take into account their apprehensions, and they certainly have to take into account ours.
In a Wall Street Journal op-ed earlier this month, you joined former Defense Secretary William Perry and former Secretaries of State George Shultz and Henry Kissinger in calling for a global effort to reduce the reliance on nuclear weapons and prevent their spread. Yet, when you look at some of the outliers here, like North Korea, like Iran, how can a global effort actually reach them when it's been the policy of most of the other nuclear countries to isolate them?
Well, of course, the North Koreans, as we've already discussed, are a very serious problem. And the Iranians are also not nearly as far along as the North Koreans with their own nuclear program. And they still declare they're not trying to have a weapon, but they're doing everything necessary to have a weapon. I consider moving to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and to get nuclear materials under control is the most important security challenge not only America faces, but we face around the globe. And a very important part of that is an international effort to squeeze North Korea and Iran and put maximum pressure, short of military conflict, if at all possible, to get them to curb their nuclear appetite, so to speak.
How much more pressure can we put on them, though? We're already isolating them to a great degree.
Well, in the case of North Korea, that's where China is so important, because we don't have economic relations with North Korea, nor do many of the people in the Pacific area. The Chinese do. So in terms of leverage when other countries other than China threaten to take sanctions against North Korea. In most cases, there are exceptions. That leverage is just not there, but the Chinese have huge leverage. The same can be said with Iran, except there's a requirement that many more countries put pressure on the Iranians, and our European allies are beginning to do that. The Iranian economy is beginning to feel the effect of sanctions. Now, the response to that is unknown. We don't know what they're going to do, but things are being done. The question is whether they're being done quickly enough and whether enough countries are joined together to understand the seriousness of the challenge.
So you think that economic sanctions in both cases, if applied properly and with a lot of persistence, would actually work?
Well, that's what we have to hope for, because nobody wants a military conflict. We have to be prepared for that kind of contingency, but certainly a war with North Korea would devastate South Korea. It would have huge economic effects in the Pacific, and a war with the Iranians would not be just a 2 or 3 week affair. It would go through the form of terrorism for many years to come. So these are very serious matters, and I don't know of anybody who studied the situation carefully who wants a conflict. But we have to be able to enforce the rules of the United Nations. We have to be able to enforce the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and this depends on countries cooperating, including Russia and including China.
Is there anything we can offer the Russians or the Chinese to help them work with us?
Well, of course, that is being done. I think it's been worked in the last two administrations, the Bush administration as well as the Obama administration, sometimes with more success than others. So we do work with the Russians and the Chinese, and we have a lot more cooperation with both those countries than probably meets the public eye. I think you also have to put it in perspective. North Korea and Iran are really very serious challenges, but there have been a number of other countries that have embarked on nuclear programs over the years that have backed off, and there are a number of countries that have given up nuclear weapons or the capacity to make nuclear weapons, including South Africa, including Kazakhstan, that had a very large stockpile of nuclear weapons, including Ukraine, that had a very large stockpile of nuclear weapons, including Belarus. So it's not all in one direction. There is progress being made, and we have also made progress in getting materials secured all over the globe. And that's one of the things that we point out in our Wall Street Journal article that is so important, is getting all weapons-capable nuclear material under control. The greatest danger I think any of us face is probably a terrorist group getting nuclear material and finding a way to make a crude device that would blow up a major part of a major city in the world. That would change the whole economic situation as well as be a human tragedy. So there are things we can work together on, including nuclear material protection, including, in my view, taking some of the weapons off of prompt launch around the globe. This should be a global effort so that we can greatly reduce the chances of some kind of accidental war between states, and including a major effort on verification so that we can better verify any kind of agreements that may emerge in the future.
Someone might listen to all of this and say, well, we're trying all these things. We have made progress in securing nuclear materials, as you mentioned, but there's a whole lot of stuff that we just don't know whether it'll work or not, and we don't have a lot of urgency at this point behind it. Nuclear threat isn't something that a lot of people are thinking about. Are you optimistic that the nuclear powers will be able to come up with a strategy that actually works?
I think we've made enormous progress. If you look at the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, that was perhaps one of the most dangerous periods in history, because we'd never had an empire collapse with huge stockpiles of nuclear, chemical, biological materials and weapons. So we went through that period with a tremendous amount of cooperation. We still have dangers, but not as much as we did. We've also had great success under the Non-Proliferation Treaty of discouraging countries from having nuclear programs. And I think you have to put it in perspective. Are there dangers? Yes. Are we making progress? Yes. Are we going to have to continue to work on this for a long, long time to come? Yes.
Part of the warning you sent, though, was that world leaders are not working fast enough to meet the nuclear threats. Did that apply to the current Obama administration?
Well, I give President Obama a large amount of credit in terms of the nuclear security summits he's had. He's had two of them, one in the United States with over 40 heads of state and one in South Korea with over 50, and they were focusing on this very important question of securing nuclear materials. There's another nuclear summit coming up in 2014. So on that score, I give President Obama a good marks. Are there other things that need doing, and there are other things that we're urging him to do? Yes, there's a whole lot that needs to be done. But the main thing is we have to understand this takes cooperation. One country cannot do it alone. The U.S. and Russia have 90% of the nuclear materials and nuclear weapons in the world, so any global partnership has to start there, and of course it has to also include China. U.S. and Russia should get many more of their weapons off prompt launch. We are still in Cold War postures, and yet the Cold War has changed immensely. And, of course, China certainly cannot expect the U.S. and Russia to continue to come down in our nuclear inventories if they decide they're going to continue to go up. So all of these things have to be worked in a bilateral but also a multilateral way.
I want to come back to North Korea for just a second, and if it's possible, I want to ask a serious question about Dennis Rodman. Is a visit like his just a distraction, or is there something to be gained from visits like that, even if it's somebody as perhaps mercurial and odd as Dennis Rodman?
Well, I think human contact and dialogue is always important, so I don't take any diplomatic effort by Dennis Rodman seriously. Many times I didn't take some of his antics when he played basketball seriously, but he was a good rebounder, I'll have to say that for him, as quirky as he was. So I don't think there's damage done here, but I don't think this is serious, and I don't think it moves the ball forward in terms of relations with North Korea.
But in their interactions with him, can we learn something about the North Korean leadership?
Well, I think you could learn he likes basketball, so maybe we can have some basketball diplomacy at some point in the future. Remember the ping-pong diplomacy mm-hmm. with China? At that stage, China was deemed to be an implacable enemy that we would never have dialogue with, and of course, now they're one of our greatest trading partners. So I believe in human progress, and I believe that right now, if you're trying to look for optimistic things in the world, and I think we need to occasionally do that with all the problems we've got, I think if you look at the great powers, you look at Russia, you look at China, you look at Europe, you look at Japan, you look at the Southeast Asian countries, you look at the United States, I think our interests align more now than we have in the last 100 years. We still have huge differences. We still have distrust. It's not going to be smooth sailing, but there's an awful lot of things going on in the world that are making the world better now and have a chance potentially to do that even more so in the future, including, of course, in this country where we are developing a lot of our own energy. Natural gas is going to be a blessing for the next 20, 30 years and perhaps much longer than that. We also have the blessings of a neighbors on both sides that are friendly. We take that for granted, but countries all over the world would love to have Canada and Mexico as neighbors. And so we have that to be grateful for. And Mexico, for instance, is making a huge amount of economic progress now. And if you take Canada and Mexico and the United States together, we're very likely to be pretty much, theoretically at least, energy independent in the next 4, 5, 6 years. So there's a lot good going on with all the problems.
Former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn is Chief Executive Officer of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and he's also a professor in the Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech. Senator Nunn, always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis. Take care.